Time for legal talk. And I know we've spoken quite a bit on the show about antenuptial contracts and how to protect oneself legally when entering into a marriage. But what about the many couples who are living together in long-term relationships without getting married? According to the 2011 census, the number is actually growing quite rapidly. The number is roughly 3.5 million people who identify themselves as living together but not married, up from 2.4 million a decade earlier. More people are opting for this kind of partnership, and yet doing so might leave them vulnerable in the event of a partner's death, especially if that partner did not leave a will behind. To discuss some recent, quite important legal developments around this issue, I'm delighted to welcome on the line Charlene May, who is an attorney at the Women's Legal Center. Charlene, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Pippa.
Prior to these latest developments, what kind of legal protection did an unmarried domestic partner have, or perhaps more pertinently, not have?
Well, in fact, the reality is that we don't have legislation that specifically speaks to legal recognition of domestic partnerships. And so that really means that there is very little to no protection or recognition that is given to women in domestic partnerships. There's been some advances that's been made through litigation. And so, for instance, the Road Accident Fund, for instance, would now recognize a partner living in a domestic partnership to be able to claim maintenance from the Road Accident Fund should their partner have died in a road accident. But that's really the only advances that have been made. They've been made through litigation. It's a common misconception that common law marriage or domestic partnerships have recognition in law.
Now, you've said a very important phrase there. I think a lot of people think that common law marriage is a thing recognized in South Africa, but just tell us what that term actually means and clarify that what you've been discussing is, in fact, what most people assume common law marriage brings with it is not the case.
Yeah, so I think that common law marriage has a bit of a history in the country, and part of it has to do with the colonialist and apartheid history of the country, where people of color's marriages weren't necessarily legally recognized through legislation. And so many people who entered into customary marriages or religious marriages, those marriages weren't legally recognized, and they effectively became what was commonly or was commonly called common law marriages. People believing that because they've made those commitments in terms of their religion or in terms of their custom, that in fact it had some form of legal effect. And the reality is that our law and our common law does not recognize those types of domestic partnerships or life partnerships as being valid legal marriages from which consequences can flow.
So important to spread that word, because I know there is a common misperception that it's linked to the number of years you've spent together, lived together, that after a certain point, it's automatically viewed as a common law marriage under law. So thank you for clarifying that is not, in fact, the case. However, we have had some recent developments here, Charlene, with the Bwanya case and a woman who took this matter to court and challenged the fact that although she had lived with somebody as a life partner and a very tightly, well-acknowledged life partnership with a long-term intention that they would get married one day, she was left out when it came time for the estate to be dealt with. Tell us briefly what happened in that case.
So I think what's very important about the case one is that Jane identified herself and her partner as having been in this domestic partnership, this lifelong committed relationship, where they had the intention of entering into a legal marriage. He unfortunately passed away before that could happen. And upon his death, he didn't leave behind a valid will. And so when you don't have a valid will or you don't have any will whatsoever in South African law, the Interstate Succession Act comes into play. And the Interstate Succession Act regulates what then happens to your estate and who can be beneficiaries of that estate. It makes specific provision for spouses and children. Those are almost your closely held family members that can inherit from your estate. And then it also talks about extended family members, such as perhaps your parents or your cousins and aunts that might be able to inherit from you. And what Jane found was that her partner didn't have any immediate family members, but he did have extended family. And that because they weren't in a legal marriage, she wasn't considered a spouse under the Interstate Succession Act, and therefore she was excluded by the executor from being able to inherit what a spouse would have inherited or benefited from that estate.
Okay, now she brought this to court and challenged it on the grounds that it was unfair discrimination on the basis of sex, of gender, of marital status and sexual orientation, as well as a violation of her right to dignity. And she was successful in that case, Charlene. So her finding was successful, but does that judgment have any legal binding on other similar relationships? What are the implications of the judgment in her individual case?
So what's wonderful is that Jane brought the case in her individual capacity, but she also brought the case on behalf of a class or group of persons that would be similarly situated or in similar circumstances to herself. And so this category of women who have been unable to negotiate a marriage, women that have been unable to conclude a marriage because perhaps death had intervened. And so because there's a class then or a group of women, in fact, before the court, what the court actually found is that there is a clear case of discrimination on the basis of gender. There's a clear case of discrimination on the basis of marital status, because all of this, the legislation, all of it assumes that there should be a particular hierarchy of rights that's bestowed onto people because of their marital status. And what the court found was that all of these were slightly outdated notions in terms of where our society has gone to. And you've talked about this a little bit in your introduction in terms of how many people in the country are actually living in domestic partnerships and identify themselves as living in domestic partnerships. And so the court took all of that into consideration and said that, in fact, yes, Jane herself was being discriminated against because she couldn't benefit from her spouse's deceased estate. But in fact, that there was a whole category of women that are similarly placed and in similar circumstances that are equally deserving of the law. And that's why the judge in the Boania matter effectively has ordered that the relevant section in the Interstate Succession Act needs to be amended in order to include partners living in a life committed or domestic partnership.
Charlene, a quick follow-up. You've been speaking quite a lot about not having concluded a marriage, and in Jane's case it was clear that there was an intention to marry one day. What about those for whom they have no intention of ever getting married but remain in a committed relationship, which is many, many people that I know have taken that decision, that this is my partner for life, but we just simply don't believe in the institution of marriage and aren't ever going to get around to it. Would that matter? It would it be relevant to what the judge has decided?
So that really was our role, Papa, in this matter. WLC came to court as friends of the court and really made submissions to say that there's two categories of persons. There's the persons that you've talked about now that make very well-informed decisions. They are informed about what their legal position is and they're informed about their rights. And so they very clearly say, I don't want to enter into a marriage. I don't want to have all of these things that attach themselves. Maybe I don't believe in marriage. And so those are the people that are on the one side of this. But on the other side of this is a whole class or category of women that, because of patriarchy, because of social norms, either don't have the ability to negotiate a marriage, so they want to enter into a marriage, but they're just simply not in a position to negotiate that and to conclude it. We made submissions to court in which we clearly illustrated that because of social norms, very often women will wait until they are proposed or asked to enter into a marriage. It's very difficult if you want to get married, but your spouse, for instance, or your partner doesn't want to enter into the marriage. You can't force them to do that. And so very often what the research tells us is that women will stay in a committed partnership or in a committed relationship and will forego marriage, even in instances where they really want to get married, because they want to be in the relationship, or very often they have children that bind them into this relationship. And so that's really the category of women that we're saying really do need to have the additional protection that this judgment can actually afford and give them.
We're talking to Charlene May, who is an attorney at the Women's Legal Center, about the implications of a recent court judgment in the Bwanya case around the position of unmarried but long-term partnered women in domestic partnerships. Charlene, what about same-sex couples? Does this ruling have any bearing on their rights?
So it's actually very interesting if we go back to a little bit of the history around same-sex couples. You would know that historically same-sex marriages weren't recognized in South Africa, and in fact, to a large extent, it was same-sex sexual actions and relations were criminalized. And so because of that history and the introduction, it took a while before the introduction of the Civil Unions Act. What then happened was that there was litigation put before the Constitutional Court. What the Constitutional Court then found was that we needed to protect couples in same-sex marriages because they weren't able to conclude a valid marriage. And so same-sex couples in domestic partnerships had these rights to inherit and had this protection available to them for quite some time.
Right.
And that was reaffirmed quite recently again by the Constitutional Court after the Civil Unions Act came into effect, to once again say, let's just continue the protection that was afforded to them previously. Regardless of the fact that they can enter into a legal marriage, there might be same-sex couples who choose not to enter into those marriages. And so, in effect, what the Constitutional Court then did was they created this disjuncture in law, or this gap that now leads to the discrimination where people in opposite sex couples don't have the same benefits as couples in same sex domestic partnerships.
Charlene, final question then is where to from here? This, you said the judge effectively ordered that the relevant sections of the Intestate Succession Act need to be amended. Does that mean the act has to go back to Parliament? Does this get kicked up to the Constitutional Court? What's the next step?
Well, what the judge proposed was a reading in. So effectively, that means that she's already suggested amended language and amended wording. And what she's suggesting is that that language just be read into the existing language. So there wouldn't necessarily be a need for the law, the legislation itself, to be amended through Parliament or through an act of Parliament. And so what we're hoping is that the Constitutional Court agrees with this decision so that there can be certainty in law, so that there can be benefit that will accumulate a bit faster than it would have accumulated through a legislative process that can sometimes take quite some time going through Parliament. The matter has been set down for confirmation by the Constitutional Court on the 16th of February next year. So we'll have some clarity, I suspect, within the first term of the court early next year around how the court feels about this High Court judgment and whether the Constitutional Court would agree with the decision that's been taken.
Well, I look forward to chatting to you then. Charlene May, thank you so much for joining us, attorney at the Women's Legal Center, and a story we'll certainly keep an eye on as the Constitutional Court picks it up in February.